Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. Oh, come on. Good evening. There you go. How are you all tonight? Doing well? It's always a pleasure for me as CEO of WHYY. My name is Bill Morazzo. It's always a pleasure for me to welcome you all to the home of your public media company, WHYY. Any of you ever hear of us? Watch TV 12? Listen to 90.9 FM? There you go. This place is a hoot and half. It's a hoot and holler. It's just really a fascinating time to be a member of the public media industry. While we do a lot of good work on air and online to ensure that you have sources of trusted news and information and easy access to creative expression here in the Delaware Valley and all forms of lifelong learning, at the end of the day, what I've grown to appreciate that what makes this place very, very special is that it is only possible to run this enterprise with the interest and the support of people like yourselves, who we are so very happy to meet off air and offline. So why don't we start by my inviting you to give yourselves a big round of applause for making HYY possible. And, you know, what brings us all together this evening is this interesting concept of newsmaking, journalism, ethics in journalism, and the, you know, the big central word, fake news. Sandy, that's a monosyllabic word. You know, fake news sounds awfully simple, and in my own judgment, too many of the issues that are covered by the news media in general take on very complex, important, rich issues and try to simplify them, which we think here at HYY is a bit of a mistake. And so while it's easy to rationalize our nation's public policy discussion between the left and the right, red state, blue state, conservative, liberal, at the end of the day, when you go right down the middle and explore the nuances of both points of view around any public policy issue, as we do try to do here at HYY, you begin to see a lot of nuanced information about the world we live in and how to become more active and engaged citizens. A quick vote from y'all. Hands up if you think our news services are different and unique. Wow. Hands up, do you trust them? Huh. You think they're factual? Holy crow. We should just go to a bar, man. It's, Well, it's interesting, right? Because, you know, we talk often. Sandy, why don't you stand up? This is our Vice President for News and Civic Dialogue, ladies and gentlemen. You know, we talk frequently, you know, a couple of times a day, every single day. You know, how can we go beyond the facts in creating a trusted news service? Because when you even just be factual in your news reporting, being factual alone is not necessarily truthful. You can string facts together in a way that you can tell a lie. Unthinkable here, of course, at HYY. But the work of providing you all with a trusted news and information service starts but doesn't end with being factual. The notion of trust is the consequence of striving to be truthful, and striving to show multiple points of view on any one issue. I've been thinking, I haven't had a chance to catch up to Sandy on this, I've been thinking a lot recently about the opiate crisis I read a report from the CDC a couple of nights ago that some 50 million Americans are thought to be either victims or abusers of one or another painkiller med. And we cover in the news a lot about that, don't we? Quick show of hands. Anybody hear a story about the abuses of opioids? It's interesting, though, isn't it? And I was so very grateful that NPR a couple of days ago, I think it was on Morning Edition, also did a story about the 2+ million people a year in the United States who rely on opioids to just run their lives normally. So it's interesting, isn't it, right, to think about on one side of the coin what it is we ought to do as a society to curb and limit the abuse of such drugs, yet on the other side, not do it so aggressively that we prevent somebody who needs those medicines from running a productive and safe life. And I like to think that over and over and over again, HYY and NPR and PBS and the public media industry, when it thinks about news making, that we show you a bit more easily the middles behind those two extremes. So we have a great lineup of people from NPR and from WHYY to walk us through the wonders of this thing called ethical journalism or fake news or non-fake news or things of that nature. And so if you would be so gracious as to help me to welcome the moderator of this evening's discussion, WHYY's general manager for all of our radio services, Naomi Starobin.
Hi, everybody. We're taping, so I have to get behind the microphone. Welcome, everybody. Bill did a great job of welcoming you. I won't go any further except to say I'm glad you're here. This is an important topic. I want to give a little shout out to a bunch of students who are here from Temple University and I believe Drexel as well, so welcome to you. I hope you'll participate actively tonight and learn something and share your own experiences too. What makes anyone an expert in ethics? Well, nobody. We've all had disagreements with friends and family about ethical issues. We might read the ethics column in the New York Times and say, I don't agree with that answer at all. That person didn't get it right this time. There's no hard and fast guidebook on ethics. There's a lot of room for interpretation. There are gray areas, even in the Ten Commandments. But journalists need rules, and the people who guide them, who edit them and manage them, need to provide those rules, and the audience, you and me, need to understand what those rules are so that we can judge whether we like this organization that's presenting the news to us. And journalistic professional societies have ethics guidelines too, as does NPR. So those gray and ambiguous areas where we can't have hard and fast rules, but we can have guidelines, that's what we're going to explore tonight. And I'm going to ask you to participate by answering questions, by voting on answers when ethical issues come up. And we're going to hear from you, we're going to hear from our panelists, and we're going to have also plenty of time for questions at the end. So let's meet our panelists. I'm starting to my left, your right. Mark Memmott is NPR's supervising senior editor for Standards and Practices, and in that role, he's a resource for NPR journalists, helping them raise the right questions as they do their work and uphold the organization's standards. Prior to being at NPR, Mark worked for USA Today as a reporter and an editor. When a standards or ethics issue needs clarifying, Mark posts his memos, with two M's, Memmott's missives and musings. And we all read them, all the NPR reporters in the system and station reporters, like some of the people on our panel, read them and are guided by them. They have ranged from what to call immigrants who are in the U.S. illegally to how to describe so-called alt-white groups to telling reporters to please avoid saying out west when describing something that happens in California because, after all, our listeners in California don't consider themselves to be out anywhere. Moving down the line, Elizabeth Jensen is NPR's ombudsman, also known as the public editor. I'm not sure which one you prefer. Public editor. Scratch the see, already fake news. Public editor serves as the public's representative to NPR. Her job is to bring transparency to matters of journalism and journalism ethics. She's been in the position since 2015, just renewed, right?
Yes, for another year, so I'll be there through January of 2019.
So Elizabeth writes regular columns highlighting issues the NPR audience have asked about or complained about or rarely or occasionally praised as well.
Right.
And that includes everything from whether the October mass shooting in Las Vegas should be called domestic terrorism to how NPR handles corrections and errors in news reports. Previously, she was a contributor to the New York Times, and she covered the public broadcasting beat. She also spent 6 years at the Wall Street Journal. Annette John Hall is a reporter here at WHYY on the Keystone Crossroads team. And Keystone Crossroads, near and dear to my heart, having been the editor of that project, is a statewide public media collaborative focused on the problems facing Pennsylvania cities and possible solutions. She also is the host of the podcast Cosby Unraveled. Annette previously was a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and early on in her career, she was a sports reporter with the San Jose Mercury News out west. Kevin McCory wears two hats here at WHYY. He is the editor of Keystone Crossroads and is also the senior education reporter here at the station. And he covers the struggles and successes of Pennsylvania's public schools and the statewide politics of education funding. And if their names aren't familiar to you, they should be. And he also hosted and produced the first season of the podcast called Schooled, which is part of the Keystone Crossroads project. Start with Mark and Elizabeth. Just help us understand what your jobs are about. Mark, tell us how your job came to be. Not every news organization has a standards editor, after all.
No, it doesn't. It came to be when NPR had some problems about 5 years ago in the handling of a firing of a commentator named Juan Williams. And when you have problems, task forces are launched. And a task force was launched to see what were those problems and what were the standards around commentary and opinion and things like that. And, of course, the task force then exceeded its grasp and decided that a standards and practices editor should be created to sort of keep an eye and help certainly just talk through the issues that come up every day, from the language we should use to our position on things like taking honorarium for speeches to just the daily sort of journalism that we all love. And I think of myself as sort of inside the newsroom as a resource, kind of like the high school principal or guidance counselor that's trying to keep everybody going in the same direction. And if you know journalists, you know how difficult that mm-hmm. task may be.
Elizabeth, as a public editor, tell us about your job. I'm mostly curious, as are most of you, I would imagine, how independent are you of this organization that you are supposed to be critiquing, basically?
Right, so that's the sort of the tension of the job, if you will. I'm paid by NPR, but I'm paid to be independent. I have a contract that's written such that they can fire me, but it would be awfully difficult. I report to Jarl Mohn, the CEO, so Mark is inside the newsroom. I am outside the newsroom, so I have no management authority. I can say what I want. I can say that NPR has made mistakes. They can listen to me or
and you
not.
Have.
Hmm?
And you have.
And
times.
I have, right. So
we'll be talking
I'm
about
essentially,
some of
I sort of like to think of myself as a reporter, which I have been all my life, but sort of a media critic, but inside the organization.
So there was supposed to be another person on the panel. Some of you may know this. Michael Oreskes, NPR's Senior Vice President of News and the Editorial Director, was scheduled to be on the panel, and he's no longer with NPR. Most of you have probably heard the news. He was forced to resign earlier this month after allegations from several women of sexual abuse came out in news reports. He accepted responsibility and apologized publicly, but this has led to a lot of questions involving journalistic ethics. It leads to this question. How should NPR handle covering this kind of news, this internal, sort of covering itself, if you will? I have some choices here. I'm going to ask you to vote. I'm going to ask Mark and Elizabeth to weigh in because they've had to deal with this question. And then we're going to show you how they did handle it. We're going to air an interview. That was part of that coverage. So how should NPR handle such news? Don't cover it because the conflicts of interest are too great. Cover it as we would any other story and trust that even NPR journalists who worked for Oreskes directly can set aside conflicts. Bring in reporters and editors from somewhere else to follow that news or something else. So show of hands, just curious. Don't cover it because the conflicts of interest are too great. Zero. Mm-hmm. Cover it as you would any other story. Trust the NPR journalists. Wow. Okay, maybe about half the hands. And bring in reporters and editors from another organization to do the work. Okay, about a quarter. Something else, whatever that it might be. Okay, one person. So tell us, O Standards editor and public editor, how did we handle this? How are we handling it?
Well, fortunately, we had established a protocol several years ago about just this sort of thing. How do we cover ourselves? We have a very aggressive, very well-sourced media reporter, David Falkenflick, who works in the New York Bureau. He's had to cover NPR before. When that happens, he and an editor who was never involved in any of the problems or decisions or news are walled off, and senior management, senior editors can't tell them what to do, how to follow the story, where to go with the story. They can't even weigh in on how many minutes David will get on All Things Considered that evening. If David thinks he needs 3.5 and his editor agrees, they get the 3.5 minutes. The only wrinkle might be I might be called in as an arbitrator if the show is basically saying, we don't have 3.5 minutes because there's this other incredible news that we have to get on, and I might have to make a call on shaving David to 3 minutes and giving the other story 4 or whatever. That hasn't even happened. There's never been a disagreement. They've been left alone to cover the story as they, being good journalists, good editors, think it needs to be covered with no interference from the top. So it's kind of the or something else. We're a little bit in between the trust our journalists, which we do, but we also want to make sure that nobody who is involved in any of those decisions or actions is covering that story.
So is it fair to say that Michael Oreskes was not involved in the coverage of that story, obviously, but other stories around sexual allegations and famous people?
We can't guarantee. We've mm-hmm. done a lot of after-action talking about this. Obviously, the Harvey Weinstein story broke several weeks before Mike. The story about Mike broke and before Mike was forced out. None of the editors who were involved in covering that story felt that they were pressured by Mike one way or the other to do this or do that. What we don't know, and I'm not sure how we can get at this, is did he not suggest something mm-hmm. because of his own experience? Did he not actively sort of push us to do a story in a certain way? I'm not sure how we're going to get at that. But as far as we don't know of any time when he directly influenced the coverage one way or the other. He sort of let it go.
Elizabeth?
Yes. So I think I heard from maybe some of you, I heard from quite a few listeners who felt that NPR should not be covering the story in-house, that they should find somebody else. So I went back and looked at that for a recent column. I'm a big fan of sort of looking at the work itself, and if you look at the reporting itself, I think it held up. I think NPR was very tough on itself. We're going to hear an interview in a minute, which I think was particularly exemplary. I don't think any outside reporter or host could have done a better job. It's certainly a conflict. There's a public radio station down in Miami that found itself in a conflict, and they actually found another reporter in Miami who was hired to come cover their situation because they just felt that they couldn't be objective. So there's a choice to be made. Bloomberg sort of famously often doesn't cover itself at all because they feel that the conflicts are too great. So there's a debate to be made, but I think NPR did do a good job in the end with the coverage.
So let's hear this interview, which was on All Things Considered, host Mary Louise Kelly talking to Yarl Mohn, the CEO of NPR. This was the day after the Washington Post article, perhaps?
Maybe 2 days?
Maybe 2 days, I think.
Maybe 2 days.
Let's have a listen.
And we are reporting on news from inside the NPR newsroom today. Our top editor, NPR Senior Vice President of News, Mike Oreskes, has resigned following accusations of sexual harassment. Three women have filed complaints, one a current NPR reporter, the other two alleging harassment from 2 decades ago when Oreskes was at the New York Times. Mike put out a statement this afternoon saying, quote, "I am deeply sorry to the people I hurt. My behavior was wrong and inexcusable, and I accept full responsibility," end quote. NPR CEO Jarl Mohn says he asked for Oreskes' resignation this morning, and Jarl joins me now in the studio. Hi there.
Hi, Mary Louise.
When did you first learn of an allegation of sexual harassment in connection with Mike Oreskes?
Well, the first situation was the one you just referred to, was the, in the fall of 15.
So just to be clear, nothing had come to your attention, no allegations at the point when you hired him in the spring of 2015? You'd
have
nothing?
None.
There have been a lot of questions about the timeline of when NPR knew what. So what I'd love to do is start there and just tick through my understanding of events as they unfolded, and please jump in and stop me if this is something that doesn't square with events as you understand them. So in 2015, NPR staffer Rebecca Hersher alleged that Oreskes made her deeply uncomfortable at a 3-hour dinner, that he asked personal and invasive questions. She complained, and Oreskes was reprimanded that same year, 2015, correct?
That's correct.
A year later, October 2016, NPR learned about a woman complaining of harassment by Oreskes at the New York Times nearly 2 decades ago. This complaint involved physical contact. She says he kissed her, he forced his tongue into her mouth, correct?
Well, that's what we heard, and that would have been, I think, in the fall of 16, yes.
Fall of 16, and then last month, a second woman complained of Oreskes' behavior during his time at the New York Times, a similar complaint that he kissed her without having been invited to do so.
Correct.
If that is the sequence, if you knew of these multiple allegations, did it cross your mind that leaving Mike in his job might put other women, might put our colleagues at risk?
Yes. Well, let's look at those three examples that you gave, Mary Louise. The first, which occurred in the fall of 15, that was an internal situation that happened here. It was a terrible situation. I condemn his actions. They were unacceptable. They're deplorable. We investigated. We did it immediately. We involved our HR department. We involved our general counsel. We sat with Mike. We confronted him about that situation and put him on notice that this could not occur. My understanding is, and again, it was reported here, David Falkenflik reported yesterday, that employee felt that we satisfactorily addressed that issue. And there's a whole range. I mean, there's a whole range of what is unacceptable behavior. This
but
was
that issue you knew about.
Yes.
When a year later, a second allegation came in.
You're referring to the New York Times.
From his tenure at the New York Times.
Again, the important distinction here is, first, that did not happen at NPR. It was not an NPR employee. It was at the New York Times, and it occurred 20 years ago. Had that happened at NPR, we would have had a very different reaction to it. It happened 20 years earlier. One of the things we wanted to do as a result of that is make sure that that did not happen here. And I will tell you, up to this moment, sitting here and talking with you, Mary Louise, I'm not aware of anything that he's done or that happened that bears any resemblance to those issues that occurred 20 years ago while he was at the New York Times.
Our media correspondent, David Falkenflik, has talked to 5 more women since last night, on top of the 3 cases that we've already discussed. 5 more women alleging inappropriate conduct by Oreskes over a period of years. Has any other claim reached your office?
I would say as a result of the published reports within the past 24 hours, we have heard of one other that has surfaced. I would say when the second New York Times story
the second woman who dealt with Oreskes in his time at the
we
at the
felt
Times.
Very strongly that we needed to there and there had been rumors circulating around the building here about his behavior, rumors and gossip. We can't act on that. We have to act on facts. I put out an email. I put out a memo, a statement asking for anyone that is experienced or witnessed any of this behavior to please come forward. We laid out a whole array of ways that they could contact us. There must have been 7 or 8 ways in. Over that 2-week period of time, we got no complaints. No one stepped forward. Unfortunately, it took the published reports to have some things surface.
But when you say it took published reports for this to surface, we're a news organization.
Yeah.
So there's a few hundred reporters out there. Why are we getting scooped by the Washington Post on this?
Why are we? You're talking about the New York Times story?
About the Washington Post story, according to New York Times Women. And I'll add to that, I learned that Mike Oreskes had resigned when I checked my phone in the line in the NPR canteen today. And the way I learned about it was via an AP news alert, Associated Press. Why did they know and we didn't?
Well, because that's not from us. We did not release it. We had a clear timeline of how we were going to release this information. While we were in our meeting planning how we were going to release that information, the AP got the story. I suspect Mike released his statement to the AP. It was not from us.
You said you can't act on rumors and gossip, but were you concerned that these accusations were creating a toxic environment in the newsroom?
Absolutely, of course. As bad as –
Should that not prompt action then?
Well, it did. Ultimately, we informally were asking questions. Clearly, we didn't do everything we could because it didn't result in the right answer. But to suggest we were not doing anything or we were not acting appropriately is not – or that we were doing nothing is false.
Let me push you again then on what did push you to act and put Mike on leave as of last night and then ask for his resignation this morning. The Washington Post published his story. He was put on leave within a couple of hours. Was that because new information came to light,
came
to you?
Yes.
But you can't elaborate on what that is.
I cannot.
A new case? A new
allegation? New case.
Internal?
Yes.
Current employee?
Yes.
May I ask the severity of the allegation?
Again, I hate...
I know, but you've talked about a range.
I understand, but I'm going to be lambasted for any specificity here. And again, I want to get to the confidentiality of the complaint. I would say on the range of, Harvey Weinstein being on one extreme and the other internal issue that the complaint that we... that you referred to earlier.
Conversation that conversation. Made a woman feel uncomfortable.
Yes. Mm. I would say it was clearly in that range.
In the uncomfortable conversation range.
Yes.
You're all moan. Our boss, NPR CEO, talking about the resignation today of our top editor, Mike Oreskes, following accusations of sexual harassment. You're all thank you.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
Yes. Just raise your hand if you changed your mind. Curious. Okay. Sort of. All right. I'm just wondering, it's clear what they decided to do, how they decided to handle it. Any follow-up comments from anybody?
I might make two observations, and I know I'm biased on this. The first page of our ethics handbook, which is public, it's at ethics.npr.org, says that, we hold public officials accountable, and we should hold ourselves to the same standards. And I think this is an example of how we tried to do that. And there's another reference in that ethics handbook, which talks about how we ask questions to get answers, not to provoke confrontations. Mary Louise, as many of us in the NPR newsroom, are incredibly angry over what happened, but I don't think her anger necessarily came through. She professionally quizzed and pushed her boss, basically, to give her some answers to explain what he was possibly thinking. So I think we held ourselves to our own standards on that case.
How was this interview received internally, and how was Mary Louise being received internally now?
With applause, mm-hmm. If not physically, messages of thank you, and people were very proud of the way we pushed for answers. We're still pushing for answers.
And say she doesn't get a job promotion she's looking for 3 years down the line.
I don't think that will happen, and... I would think that maybe Mary Louise ensured she gets a job promotion somewhere down the line because she did such a good job.
And there is a pretty strict wall between management at NPR and the newsroom. So Jarl specifically says he doesn't take any role in the newsroom, so presumably those decisions would be made in the newsroom and not by Jarl.
Okay, let's move along, and we can circle back to this when we have time for questions and answers. There's lots more to say. Should journalists vote? This is something that I'm sure you students in journalism schools are talking about, and lots of editors and journalists are talking about all the time. Should journalists vote? Should journalists register for a party? Kevin and Annette, what do you do personally?
I vote. I was a columnist here in the city for 7 years, and so I think a lot of people know my views anyway. Would I put the Cory Booker sign on my lawn that was given to me by my...
You should explain, did you live in New Jersey?
I live in Jersey. That was given to me by my neighbor, the freeholder? No. You know, I'm not going to put any sign on my lawn, but I'm definitely, if I'm advocating to my readers that, you know, voting is a right and that, you know, when I went in to vote for Obama, you know, I brought pictures of my parents with me, as so many of us did, then I'm not going to vote, you know, because I'm a citizen and too many people died for my right to do so, and that kind of trumps being a journalist as far as I'm concerned.
Are you registered for a party? And
yes.
Don't tell me which one if you're okay.
Yes, I am.
Okay, Kevin?
I'm unaffiliated and I do vote proudly, yeah.
What is the NPR standard on voting and registering for a party?
Journalists are not encouraged. Journalists are allowed to vote if they wish. Registering for a party is an interesting question. We have a fairly easy out. I live in Virginia, and you can register as an independent. I've never had to register for a party since I moved there in 1983. In D.C., where a lot of our journalists live, if you don't register as a Democrat, you effectively do not have a voice in local government. So we're not going to tell people who live in D.C. that they can't register as a Democrat and vote in that primary. What we do ask is, like you were saying, no signs on the front yard, no bumper stickers on your car driving into NPR's garage. Don't donate to the political parties because that will show up on the FEC's lists. And basically do your jobs as independently and impartially as we expect.
I mean, I will say that I know probably half the political journalists that I've known over the years do not vote. They feel that they don't want to be in a position of taking a side. One could argue that they're perhaps the most informed of any citizens out there in terms of sort of the issues, but they just feel that if they're forced to choose in the voting booth, that that will sort of influence the way that they're reporting on the issues. So.
And I neglected to ask you what you think. I apologize. Should journalists vote? Yes, fundamental right and responsibility of all citizens. That is the majority of people here. Or no, got to be completely, whoa, zero.
Nope.
Okay.
There's a couple.
I'm sorry, missed it. Yeah. One person. Okay.
And that is the position that Len Downey, who edited the Washington Post, took for years. Don't register, don't vote. Mm-hmm. Now, he being the editor of the Washington Post, perhaps he had even more pressure on him not to show any any bias.
Right, and of course, the issue of registering for a party is some of it is perception, right? So this gets in an issue that we talk about a lot. Sort of, is there a perception that you're biased as opposed to actually letting your work speak for itself? But if people see that you have registered for a party, then they think, oh, you're biased towards that party.
And you see a lot of journalists now. I mean, social media sort of gives you away, right? I mean, you know, I followed Jake Tapper on CNN, and it's pretty clear how he's leaning. You know, if you follow any of the hosts on Fox News, at least they give you the perception what party they're affiliated with. So I think with this age of social media, you know, I think that all objectivity goes out the window as far as, you know, political neutrality is concerned.
But there are guidelines on social media, too, that reporters are expected to follow.
Yes.
Right.
And not reveal opinion.
Absolutely. And I don't say anything when I post something, but I get to choose what I post. But I don't make a comment on anything. Just post it. And if I do write a status, then I'll lift a quote from the story itself and just quote it.
Kevin, who are you going to?
Oh, I was going to talk about social media, too. I mean, it makes me, you know, very uncomfortable to read through some of the people I know who work in or out of this building in journalism and see the sort of things they're posting in social media where I don't feel comfortable going there at all. So I was just curious what the policy is at NPR.
If you wouldn't say it on the air, don't say it on Twitter. Is the thing that makes sense to radio people. But basically, yes, behave as if you're in public because you are. And we talk a lot about how with Twitter and the restriction, although it's been lifted a little bit on number of characters, you know, you use it as a reporting tool to explain why you're retweeting that story or why you're posting this so that people won't be confused. But keep your opinions to yourself, basically.
And there are critics who are out there. I get a steady stream of, you know, emails every day saying, why is your reporter saying this or tweeting this or retweeting this? So, I mean, people are looking sort of, I mean, some of them are trolls, it's true, but people are looking to find a way to criticize the journalism. So it's sometimes better to just stay neutral.
How much should a reporter cozy up to interviewees? Should the reporter do whatever it takes to get a good story? And of course, you know, I'm answering with black and white kind of answers. Or are there boundaries that shouldn't be crossed? So I'll remember to ask you to vote. Whatever it takes to get a good story? No hands going up. All right, that was a little extreme. There are boundaries that shouldn't be crossed. Okay, that's most people. So let's talk about the boundaries, and I will ask you, Annette, to describe your personal experience that sort of led us to ask this question.
Yeah, it was a question that I submitted to Naomi because this happened to me all the time when I was covering sports. I was the beat writer for the Denver Nuggets for the defunct Rocky Mountain News in the late 80s and early 90s. And it was a cutthroat competitive market. We were competing against the Denver Post. Circulation numbers for both newspapers were high. Denver Post, Denver is a sports town. They love their Nuggets. They love their Broncos. This was before they had a baseball team, but they love their Rockies now. And so anyway, I was the beat writer. And so let me just set this scenario up for you. I was the first woman on the beat. I was certainly the first African-American on the beat. I was told by my editor before I went on my first road trip, now you know, Annette, people are going to be looking at you. And so you have to be very careful. As if I couldn't help myself, you know, because after all, I'm around all these millionaires who just want to hit on me, and I'm not going to be able to help myself. I'm going to succumb at some point, right? And so, you know, while I was offended by that, I mean, he threw down the gauntlet as far as I was concerned, and I knew then that I had to be above reproach. And so I always kept that in mind. Never mind that I had more in common in some instances with the athletes than I had with my competition, my fellow journalists. I remember, anybody knows me knows I love to shop. And so during off days on road trips, I'd get calls from players. And this was before cell phones. And so it was, you get a call in your hotel room, and it was from a player. They knew I loved to shop. They would be like, we're going to Galleria. We'd be in Dallas. We're going to the Galleria. Come with us. We know you like to shop. No, I don't think so. Well, come get some soul food with us. I'm sorry, I can't. And then after the game, I would be coming through the lobby of the hotel, and I would see my competition, the guy from the Denver Post, sitting in there having beers with the players. And they'd be telling me, come on, come on, have a drink with us. And no. And this was, everybody knew what kind of newspaper war there was, you know. And I felt so badly that I could not sit there and have a glass of wine. And I knew that players were just spilling, just giving them all kinds of good stories to remember. And I felt really bad about that. I mean, I got my share of stories, but I knew at that moment I was losing out on getting stories too. And so it really comes down to what you are comfortable with doing as a beat person. You're going to be with these guys for 9 months out of a year. You're going to be traveling with them. What is your comfort level with them? And I always tell people, had I known then what I know now, because part of it was I lacked the power within myself, you know. I know what I would do now. I would step right into that bar. I would have a glass of wine, maybe two glasses of wine, and I'd ask all these questions that I needed to know the answers to so I could write the stories to blow the lid off the town. But I was so insecure. It was my first beat. I knew my editor was looking at me in that way, that I felt like I couldn't do anything. It paralyzed me. So I think that what you have to do is establish your own standards as a person who is working a beat like that and determine what line you're not going to cross and what line is okay to cross. I remember when I was getting ready to leave, I left Denver to take a job in San Jose. And one of the players said, "You're leaving?" And I said, "Yep." He said, "Good, now we can be friends." So that told me that I had done my job, you know, because they would be like, "Now, why don't you come? You don't never come nowhere with us. You don't
can't do it."
So that told me, those, just that one little sentence told me that I had done my job. But It really is up to the reporter to establish his or her own set of standards in that situation.
And what does NPR say?
Well, it is hard because there is a line, and it's hard to find, between being too close to the people you cover. You know, we're not there to be the friends of the White House. We're not there to be the friends of the people in Congress that we cover. But you do want to get to know them, and you're going to get to know them by going out with them once in a while, by seeing what they're like in the off hours, by getting the off-the-record, you know, conversations that may tip you off to something down the road that you can pursue. So I think we would say, no, don't shut yourself off. Don't shut yourself off from all those kinds of possible encounters. But like you say, keep your spidey sense going about when it might not be a good idea.
Can I just add something to that, Mark? Yeah. This happened a lot on the road. We go into cities. I have friends in various cities, girlfriends. We go out to a club and see those guys in the club that we were in. Oftentimes with women who were not their wives. Now, I would tell my girlfriends, let's go, because if something jumps off in here, I do not want to cover this story. So let's go. And that happened like a handful of times. So,
okay.
You know, I think that this might touch on something that's pretty pertinent, and there's a debate, I think, in the city about it, right? So there's this press club called the Pen and Pencil, and they hold these off-the-record events with politicians, school district officials, superintendents. And there's been this debate, like, should this be a sanctioned event where you're, you know, getting a bunch of journalists together in a room in front of some powerful figure in the city, and we're going to say this is all off the record? And is that too cozy? And I think there's a line there between, well, maybe they're going to say something that could inform a story down the line that's interesting, or maybe that just breeds of some too close corruption that exists too much in the city already. So I just thought that's an interesting example that there's still a debate about right now.
And has there been a story that sort of the reporters have known about that they didn't report because it was off the record, that they learned about it at that event?
I don't think so, because in truth, when you go to these things, they're pretty lame. And it's not like it's not like the people are being that forthright. They might just be talking a little more casually than they would have. And like, okay, you'll chat with them over a beer about something. But it hasn't been that revelatory, honestly.
Okay, next question. The act of reporting on a person's life, exposing personal details to the audience, means that the reporting itself may have an impact on his or her life. Should we worry about that? Yes, it's not right to use a subject for a story and not be concerned about his or her welfare. Or no, if the subject agrees to be in a story, he or she takes the risk. So, show of hands, yes? So maybe a quarter of the people here, and no? And so a lot of undecideds. So this is connected with a story that Kevin, actually the podcast that you are the host of, Schooled, that I edited at the time. And we had a lot of talks about the right way to sort of move on some of the content of the podcast and the timing of it. So just set it up. Tell us what the podcast is about.
Sure. So the podcast is about this really incredible young woman who grew up in North Philadelphia, and it followed her journey to graduate or not graduate high school last year. And her story is very traumatic, and there's a lot of difficult parts in the story, and she is very revealing to me over the course of more than a year of interviews. We became very trusting of one another. And so, you know, it got to the point where we were going to be putting the story out there, and I think we've really had to consider how it would impact her, how it would impact her life, because this wasn't a public official who we were asking hard questions of. This was a, you know, young woman who was opening up her life to us and sharing in a way that, frankly, most people don't share in a way that I think is incredibly affecting and moving and reveals a lot about humanity and maybe what it means to live in this city or the world. But at the same time, 10 years down the line, so she was 18, 19 through the course of our reporting. So 10 years down the line, is she going to regret that when you do a Google search on her name, this is the story that will show up? And she will have characterized things in that way. Her daughter, who is 5 years old in the story, she's named in the story. You know, what's this going to feel like to her when she's 22? So we grappled with that a lot. And I felt confident that every time that I had an interview with her, and often in the midst of when she was talking about something extra sensitive, you know, I would stop and say, Savannah, like, it looks like it's you and me in the room right now and I'm holding a microphone, but like, this is going out to everybody. Like, don't be fooled. This is going to be very public if you still are willing to go down this road. And every time she said, no, I understand that, and I want my story to be told. And she felt very empowered in the end. I was very happy that when it all did come out, she felt like we gave her a voice and a platform that she wouldn't have had otherwise, and she very much appreciated that. So that was a lot, I guess, you know, to think about how it was going to impact her life. That was the conversations that we had at the time. And I think the question also gets to this idea of just the act of observing something changes it. So if you listen to the story, you know, she struggles with, is she going to make it through school? The principal seems like she's going to keep her from attending the graduation ceremony at one point in the story. In the end, she allows her to go, and she, in fact, pays her graduation fee. And I think you could ask serious questions about whether or not that would have happened if I wasn't there watching it happen, right? If I wasn't there reporting the story, it kind of forces the hand of the people who were making those decisions, and the school district, obviously, who I'm interacting with, and they're putting pressure on the school in a certain way. And again, like I said, even Savannah herself, at that point in the year, didn't have many people who were in her corner, didn't have many people who were encouraging her, but I was there to do that. But here I am also telling the story as an objective person. So that made it, difficult to draw that line between objectivity and subjectivity, because, you know, we talk about objectivity, but is it do we objectively say, ah, whether or not this child graduates high school, I'll be objective to that. Whether or not this school system succeeds or fails, I'll be objective to that. Mm-hmm. We kind of don't, right? We're at least for the idea that people should have the ability to succeed if they work hard. And clearly she was working hard. But it's caused all sorts of questions for me that we resolved them as we did, and you can listen to the story. Well,
and you and I at one point had to decide whether to hold the story until after graduation.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah, so we were afraid that if we put the story out at a certain point of the year, which was timed to a grant deliverable, whole nother conversation, that it might jeopardize her because she says things that, you know, could be seen as damning to the school or the school system.
And maybe there would be retribution.
Yeah,
she wouldn't graduate.
Retribution in some way that I felt like wasn't going to be fair to her and fair to her life. And I pushed for us waiting until after graduation. Both for the sake of her and honestly, too, for the sake of the story. The story was going to resolve better to find out whether or not she graduated. It wouldn't have made much sense, honestly, to do it before then. But, yeah, those were all the sorts of things that we grappled with. And I think that we made the right decisions at the end. But, yeah.
It's a very good podcast. You should listen to it. Schooled. Any other comments on...
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like you did exactly, and you asked exactly the same questions that we probably would have. This has all gotten really complicated because of this darn internet. One of the most common questions we get, if not every week, at least a few a month, is will you take down that story or will you take my name out of that story? And it might be a story from 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And someone has regrets now because they were young and they're trying to get a job or they're trying to get into grad school or they, you know, were young and irresponsible when they should have been young and irresponsible. And now they regret having told us about it. And our answer is, well, we're sorry, but our stories are part of a public record. And we have this compact with our audience that we're not going to make those stories disappear. However, tell us what's going on. What kind of problems is this creating for you? Did you understand at the time? Like, it sounds like you and Savannah had an understanding. She knew this was going to be not just on the air, but on the web. It was going to be there. Did you understand that? And in one or two cases, we've made some adjustments to stories. You can do things like add a little bit of code to the, I don't understand it, but you can add a little bit of code so it doesn't show up at the top of Google searches and things like that. When we felt we might have not lived up to protecting someone as well as we could have, but it's a tough subject.
Let's ask another question. Is a news outlet responsible when a host is interviewing lies? Yes, the host should immediately point out the error, or no, it's unreasonable to expect a host to react that quickly. There should be follow-up. So, show of hands, yes. Okay. That's a question. Good question. Do they know it's an error? Yeah, vote twice. Vote early and often. And who says no? Okay, so it's... fewer hands. A lot of people aren't sure, which is completely fair. We're asking the tough questions. Elizabeth, why don't you set this up, and then we'll play the tape.
Sure. So this was a big issue, in particular, earlier in the year at the change of the administration. There were a couple, when NPR was asking for White House interviews, in particular, they were given Sebastian Gorka. And this came up quite a few times with him, so I will single him out. But it certainly was not. It certainly happened on both sides of the aisle.
And remind us about who Sebastian Gorka is.
He was the White House security advisor.
One of the national security advisors
at the White House. So Morning Edition has a policy of doing live interviews whenever they can. It keeps the show timely. You get really, you know, good information in really quickly. The problem is when you have someone who comes on in a live interview and the host doesn't necessarily catch the error. Hosts try to be prepared. For the most part, I think they are. But it's a question whether this was a deliberate strategy to lie or miss, you know, post misleading data. But there were a couple times, more than a couple times, when the hosts were just not catching the mistakes. So I think NPR really grappled with sort of how to deal with this. It's the interview. So if you're on the East Coast and you're getting up early and you're listening between 5 and 7 a.m., you're hearing that live interview. If you are on the West Coast, you might be hearing the repeat of that live interview. So they're not doing the live interview three times in a row. That single interview is airing over and over and over. So you have the potential that this error would just keep getting perpetuated across the morning. And so that was essentially the main issue. So NPR did find a way to handle it. Should we listen to the interview first, and then we'll talk about why this
see
was...
See what they did, and then we'll see
good,
how we like it.
Good, but not perfect solution.
It's another week, which potentially means another executive order from President Donald Trump. Now that the administration's initial order on immigration has been waylaid in the courts, the White House is said to be mulling over other options. All this comes as President Trump has directly attacked judges in this case. Earlier, I spoke with Sebastian Gorka. He is a deputy assistant to the president. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me back.
President Trump and other members of the administration have repeatedly said the courts have no ability to review this matter. Yesterday, Stephen Miller said, and I'm quoting here, the judiciary is not supreme. What does that mean?
Well, it means that we have separation of powers in the United States, and it seems as if certain judges deny that and think they have the ultimate authority when it comes to national security. So you don't have to read anything more into statements like that. And the fact is that the judiciary or specific judges are making gross mistakes. Just last year in 2016, a Senate subcommittee said there have been 72 people from the seven countries listed on that executive order who have been convicted of terrorist offenses in the United States since September the 11th. So when a judge or when anybody says these seven countries pose no threat to America, they're just flatly wrong, and that's the problem.
Let's take a moment to examine that claim. Mr. Gorka is referring here to a report from the Center for Immigration Studies, which is a group that advocates for less immigration to the U.S. The Washington Post has fact-checked this report, and they found that while some of the 72 people on the list were convicted of providing material support to terrorists, it also included people who were convicted of passport or visa fraud, not terrorism-related offenses. They found that it earned a, quote, 3 Pinocchios rating out of a possible 4, which means the Post found there to be significant factual errors in that claim. So now let's get back to the rest of that conversation with Sebastian Gorka. And I asked him about President Trump's specific attacks on judges. You know, even the president's pick for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, has said that Trump's attacks on the judges in this particular case were, quote, disheartening and demoralizing. Do you think there's a problem with the president undercutting the judiciary as he has?
No, because I don't think that story was completely accurate, and nor do I think the president is undercutting anybody. If you look at the rights the president has as the chief executive, as the commander-in-chief, they are explicit and they are watertight. The law from the 1950s, the law from the 1980s, and even the most recent law says it is solely the prerogative of the president to decide under which standards individuals of a foreign nationality come into the United States and to adjust the requirements by which they are allowed in. So that's not...
We don't need to get into the merits of the case now, but it's really more specific...
But you're getting into the merits.
Well, it's specific to how President Trump has talked about individual judges. And I think what Judge Gorsuch was talking about was the way that the administration has been going after individual judges, calling them so-called judges and undermining their authority. That's what he was referring to.
Well, judges are human beings. I mean, they can make mistakes. And when you look at the Ninth Circuit, their rulings have been reversed 82% of the time. So the idea that they're infallible is just fallacious.
And we should take a moment to clarify that statement. It's not that 82% of the cases heard by the Ninth Circuit get overturned. According to PolitiFact, roughly 8 out of 10 cases that eventually make it up to the Supreme Court get overturned. My conversation with Sebastian Gorka also touched on the controversy around National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. While I have you, I want to ask you about another issue. Retired General Michael Flynn, the National Security Advisor. The Washington Post has reported that he talked with Russia's ambassador about U.S. sanctions, that this conversation, perhaps more than one, happened before the Trump administration took office in January. We've got a cut a clip of tape from House Democrat Adam Schiff. This is what he told us on the program today.
If those allegations are true, it's staggering, and he ought to be, if not fired, he should be given a chance to step down. But this has to be investigated. I think the consequences are just enormous.
Did General Flynn lie to the administration about these conversations?
Again, this is really, you know, spin beyond spin. I've worked with General Flynn. I was part of his national security transition team between the election and the inauguration. He is a man of honor, a soldier's soldier, a person who served the Republic in the cloth of the Republic. So these kinds of accusations aren't just simply not don't merit comment.
So did he not broach sanctions with the Russian ambassador then?
I wasn't part of the conversation, so I have no idea.
Vice President Mike Pence went out and defended him. There is some confusion in the White House as to what is accurate at this point, whether or not General Flynn, who now says he can't recall if he broached sanctions or not, but Vice President Pence defended him. Is that a good thing to have the vice president defending something that's now being called into question?
Another man of honor defending a man of honor. Yes, it's an excellent thing.
Does the president still have the full confidence of General Flynn to serve as national security advisor?
I'm not his spokesman, and I don't speak for the president. I'm a deputy assistant on national security issues in the Strategic Initiatives Group. So really, that's a question for the president.
Sebastian Gorka is the deputy assistant to President Donald Trump. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
So you see what NPR did, and that was in the rollover, that was in the later...
Exactly. So if you heard the live version of that interview, you didn't hear her stopping and saying, correcting the facts. So this is a solution to the problem, but it's only a partial solution. There were probably 3 or 4 million people who heard that live interview. And that's just... the column I wrote, I said basically that's too many people who heard that interview who didn't get the corrected information. I'm not blaming the Rachel here. Those were somewhat obscure studies that he was citing. You know, it's not necessarily possible for everyone to know every study that's going to come out. So,
and what we need to do, and we're talking about the best way to do this, is probably come back the next morning for the people who heard the East Coast feed to give them a sense of you heard some things that we challenged, that we fact-checked. We could even just throw them to NPR.org to hear the full story kind of thing.
Right.
And I might just point out, pro tip for everybody, when you heard Rachel say in the introduction earlier we spoke, mm-hmm. that's a key that was taped. And those little things in the middle where she reset, that's also a key that this isn't live. There's something going on here, and NPR is trying to, we're not tricking you, we're just improving it for you.
I have a question. So would that policy be triggered no matter what the live interview is, or is it a presidential interview or one of their surrogates, or is it, oh, we think this person potentially could lie, so we're going to preemptively plan for this?
There's certainly a lot more planning. There's a lot of planning done for every interview, but when you know going in that someone is going to try to spin you, the producers and the hosts try as best they can to game out, here's how this person has done it in the past, here are the ways they've tried to steer the conversation, and here are the right answers. So I don't know what the pregame production was like before the Gorka interview. I'm sure they did some. I don't know that they expected him to go to the 82% of cases. Mm. If you recall the famous interview that Scott Simon did with Bill Cosby, where he asked Cosby about the allegations and Cosby sat there and did not say a word, Scott and his producers had game planned. What if Cosby just sits there and doesn't say anything? Silence on radio is not a good thing. But they... had it, they were ready, Scott was ready to come back in and basically say, I think he said something like, you're nodding your head, you're shaking your head, mm-hmm. you're not going to answer. Mr. Cosby, I want to give you the chance. They worked all that out. That was a case where we did that sort of preliminary planning and got it right, I think.
So just as one follow-up, NPR has, over the summer, came up with a new strategy, which I'm actually quite in favor of. So when they're doing live interviews now, they often, and it's not even, I think, lie is sort of not necessarily the word. Sometimes people just misspeak or they are spinning, as Mark said. So the new strategy is often to have a beat reporter who is in the studio or on the phone or queued up live as well. So they'll do the interview, and then they'll have the beat reporter come back on and say, you know, the host will say, okay, so what did you hear there? Was it accurate? Give us some more context. And what I like about that is that it keeps the facts together, right? So you don't have to worry about the rollover or the rebroadcast. You don't have to worry about coming back the next day and correcting it. It's just all of a piece right there. So, and that seems to be working out, I think, pretty well.
And we know that even when there are corrections published or broadcast, it's not the same audience hearing the correction. So right. That's a problem.
Right. So keeping it all together is helpful.
So I wanted to give you all some time to ask questions of our panelists. So please use the microphone in the front of the room. And I'm talking to you, Temple University, and anybody who has a question. And if you don't, I'll keep asking questions. Come on up. Can you talk?
You got to get right up on the mic.
Get close to it.
Okay. I'm a student from Temple University.
It's not on.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's better. I always ask, do you mind if I use your quotes? Do you mind if I use your name? And they'll say yes. They'll agree to be recorded. However, afterwards, sometimes they email me and they say, well, I don't like what I said. Can you send me what you're going to use? It's against our policy to do that. Am I in the wrong to continue to use their quotes?
So you got a legal and an ethical issue here. Our lawyers will tell you that a private person has the right to withdraw consent before you hit the publish button in the newspaper or the broadcast button at a radio station. So if that person's a private individual who you were talking to about a story that is not of high public interest, they have the right to withdraw their consent. And ethically, yeah, you can't force somebody to be in your story. Now, if it's Senator so-and-so out in front of the Capitol building, no, you don't get to withdraw your consent, Senator. You're a public official. And it's good that you try to clear the ground rules ahead of time. That's very good.
Right. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Laura Hudson. I'm a media studies and production major at Temple University. And I wanted to ask, how do you keep an ethical layout when you're definitely interviewing somebody who has been known to lie consistently? Like, you want to just roll your eyes every time they speak. And, you know, it's that kind of thing where I tend to struggle a little bit. I'm the type of person that I don't have a poker face at all. And so if I'm interviewing somebody and I know that they're lying, it's, you know, how do you spin it back to try to, because I know that you can correct it like you did before, but if you're in the middle of it, you catch it. How do you spin it back and make it sound like you're just trying to report the news versus trying to sound biased? Hmm.
There's all sorts of questions that, you know, follow-ups. What are your facts? What's the basis for what you're saying?
Well, like, if
you're... No, I'm asking, that's what you could say to that person.
Yeah.
You know, right. You often ask them
what's
to cite
your evidence?
Their sources.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And try to keep your poker face.
Yeah.
Work on that.
That's definitely something that I'm working on. But, yeah, it's just a lot of the time, especially in politics, it's like you go up to these people, you want a straight answer, and they look you dead in the eye and lie. And it's just, it's frustrating. And I think that's probably the biggest ethical concern that I have as far as, you know, interviewing and writing and so on and so forth.
Were you doing a radio interview live?
I'm still very new to to writing. I write for Klein College.
Okay.
So there's been instances where it seems like somebody was not telling me the truth, and you know I kind of push on it, and they just stick to their guns, kind of thing. So again, I'm very green at this. So, but I don't want to get into a situation where they're just lying to me. I report the lie, and then
I guess I was asking if you were just getting tape for a story that you were going to put together later.
Yes. Okay.
Because yes. I'm running into that. I interviewed Ed Pawlowski, who is the mayor of Allentown, who was just elected to his fourth term despite being indicted on a play-to-pay scheme, 44-count indictment.
54. 54.
Thanks, editor. He's my editor.
Fact check.
And so... I told Kevin today I need to verify everything he told me because I don't believe him. And so I ran into a stat today he told me about the unemployment rate, and I went to the Department of Labor Statistics, and it gave me another number rather than the one he gave me. So I emailed his communications director, and I said, look, Ed said when we talked that the unemployment rate had gone down 3 points in the over three years from this to this. Well, according to the Department of Labor Statistics, it says this. Who's right? And where is he getting his information from? So verify, verify, verify. I mean, that's the best I can tell you to do, especially when you have time and you're not doing it live and you're going to produce a story when you get back.
So you can all feel very good about the story that we will broadcast when Annette finishes her fact-checking.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Liz, and I had a question about doing stories on people, like the story you were talking about with the student. And it's one thing to get consent and have that like ongoing discussion when they're living, but what happens if you're doing a story on someone who is dead or if they die partway through the story? I have a the Serial podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And the subject died partway through and the story continued. And I was wondering how that changes the reporting, the ethics kind of surrounding that when they're no longer available to give consent?
It's a really good question.
It is.
I'm trying to think back on my reaction to Serial as it went along and that character died. Clearly that character all along had wanted his story told, and the reporter was doing his best as best he could to tell what happened to him along the way and to find out why he had died and what had happened to the other characters in the story. I think if you use that as sort of your guide that you're going to get to the truth of this person, you're probably going to be fine. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Dylan. I'm a Globalization and Development Communication graduate student at Temple. As an organization that kind of focuses on, you know, the big T truth and tries to exist independently of political affiliation, where do you draw the line between neutrality and objectivity, both as an organization and for your journalists?
Everybody always looks at me.
You set the policy.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, our job is to not tell people what to think, but to give them the information they need to think and to make decisions. And to me, that's more about what objectivity and neutrality are. You know, we're not going to agree with one side or the other if the facts don't support their cases. We're going to give people the facts so that the public can understand. And you know, we're part of this democratic experiment, and that's our role, is to dig down to, as best as we can, get to the truth. I'm not sure in many cases whether anybody can get to the truth about some subjects, but the facts will at least get us most, if not all, the way there.
So that includes a policy of avoiding sort of false equivalency or false balance. You don't want to sort of present both sides as equal. In climate change, for example, they're not. There is a lot of established science out there. I occasionally get pushback from some listeners and readers who feel that NPR doesn't report the the other side fairly. I've been comfortable with the way NPR has reported it. So, yeah, I think you have to ultimately, we're the best fact finders out there, or we're supposed to be. So you have to figure out what the facts are, and you have to tell the facts, even if that ultimately favors one side or the other.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mike. I'm also a Temple student, and I'm in a radio and podcast production class right now, and we were assigned to listen to a This American Life episode called Act 5 about prisoners performing Shakespeare in prison. And we were assigned to listen to it because there's a portion where the narrator sort of takes you out of the story a little bit and inserts his perspective on the story. And especially in podcasting, I was wondering if you think there's really a place for that, like where the reporter inserts themselves into the story and gives her perspective, especially when it runs contrary to what's being reported on. I wonder if you just think there's a place for that in journalism.
Well, we grappled with that with the Cosby Unraveled podcast because, you know, I had my own dealings with Bill Cosby when I was a reporter at the Inquirer. I knew him to be a bully, not someone who drugged and raped women, but I knew him to be a bully. So it was easy for me to make the stretch that he could have done what he did because I wrote a column that he took offense with, and he called me up. That's his MO. He gets the reporter's direct extension and calls the reporter himself. I'm not the first woman reporter that he's done that to. He did that to other people. I'm a reporter at the Daily News and another.
He did that to me early in my career, yes.
You too. Me too. He did that to several women. And so it wasn't that easy, that it wasn't that hard for me to think that he did what he did. And myself and my two colleagues talked about perhaps inserting.
This is now, you're talking about the podcast now.
I'm talking about Cosby Unraveled. And because Jeanette and Lindsay, my producers, thought that maybe it would be good for me to put my story in there, my personal interaction with Cosby. I didn't want to do that because I wanted to tell the story not based on. I always feel really uncomfortable when I'm injected in the story. I'm the storyteller, you know, not the subject of the story. And I just felt uncomfortable doing that. I think in some instances it works. I've heard podcasts where, you know, the narrator comes out of the storytelling and talks about, you know, an instance, their own personal experience. But I don't think in this case it did.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Bintu. I'm a sophomore in high school. And my question is, what is the most difficult thing about radio news?
The most difficult thing?
Yes.
Explaining complex things that have no characters in them, that are policy-driven and boring, and making them interesting to people who are driving their cars on the way to work, thinking about anything else but what you want to talk to them
about. In a minute.
In a minute. Yeah. Some of the biggest complaints I get are actually about that. It's that people will hear particularly the newscast, the NPR newscast, and a story will be shortened into 1 or 2 minutes, 1 or 2 sentences, 30 seconds, and they'll be like, you didn't tell this, or you didn't tell that, or you missed this part of the story. And if the reporters had told the entire story, it would have taken up the entire 5-minute newscast.
We like to do that.
Exactly.
We'll take over,
no, yeah. But it's a challenge to sort of, I think, I don't work in radio. I work in print and I critique radio. But I think it is a challenge for radio to tell stories concisely and get in as many facts as the audience would like.
But there's no question. Every time a reporter and an editor decides to do this story and not that one, and decides to include this information and not that information, and this person and not that person, all of these decisions are important and impact what's said in the story. Not just what the facts that you say, but the decisions, all those decisions you make leading up to it.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Biederman. I'm a political science and journalism reporter, or major at Temple, and I'm also a reporter for the Temple News. A lot of my professors tell us that we should, like, go out and do our independent content so that we get writing and we have clips out there. But I run a blog, and it's a political blog because I want to be a political reporter, but I really struggle with not including any bias, and it's really hard, especially when you don't have editors. So what are your thoughts on this? Like, how should I approach a blog and independent content and, like, still protect my career in the future?
You should have an editor, first of all. Find an editor.
Yes, I often say to people that the difference between a fake news website and a real news website is that there are editors involved, pushing the reporters to do better and to substantiate their facts. But yes, it sounds like you've got a good start, that you're trying not to show biases, you're trying to do straight reporting, you're trying to show that you can write. That's all great. See if you can get some other outlets to pay you for doing that along the way, or some good internships so that you can build those clips. And you've got a good start. I do want to admit, though, that when interns come to NPR and they often ask, do I have to scrub my social media feeds? Do I have to erase everything that I've ever blogged about? I do try to counsel them that, no, you don't have to erase your life. You are a student. You are allowed to try different things. You are allowed to express yourself in ways. But once you make the commitment to be a journalist, commit to being a journalist and show that you can do it.
I would just add, one of the things that Mark always says is check your own biases, which I think is just really good, as a reporting tool, but it's something that you could also perhaps use. You say, okay, what are the facts? What if I saw this from a completely opposite point of view? Have I considered this opposite point of view? Have I included these points of view? Have I made an effort to sort of be fair? So that's just one way of sort of going back and checking your own reporting that you do as a reporter anyway.
So. You know, one of the things that we did that was a real eye-opener for me was a series that we did called I Voted Trump. And, you know, Pennsylvania turned red for Trump, and we were curious about why that was. And we scoured the Commonwealth and found people who voted for him, lots of people, and would go back to them periodically to ask them what kind of job they think he's doing. And one of the young women that we spoke with voted for Obama in 2008 and 12, right, Kevin? She was the one with baby Trump?
Oh, I think she was 08 Obama, 12 McCain.
Okay.
Or 12 Romney.
Okay. So, but anyway, I would have never thought that someone who would vote for Trump would have voted for Obama. And so that was a real eye-opener to me. So Elizabeth is right. You know, that was my bias. Every time I was assigned to do a man on the street story, like, go get reaction. Editors love to tell you that. Go get reaction, right? I would always go to the person that I felt I would feel the most uncomfortable talking to at a cocktail party, maybe. You know, maybe that was the old white guy from the South or something like that. You know, I'm just... But I would find that person because I wanted everybody to be represented. Mm-hmm. And who knows? I mean, you know, the reaction he would give me would maybe the most compelling reaction I would get all day. So you really, really do have to be open like that as a journalist.
And I would say, right, newspapers and media outlets have been gutted in recent years and decades, and they don't have the reporters out there doing all the things that they wish they were doing. Find a niche in politics that you could fill, and you'll become valuable.
Thank you so much.
Our first non-student approaching the microphone.
You don't know that.
I do, actually.
Type B.
She does know that. Yeah, right. This is, my name's Lisa Lapp, and this is a family member who is a journalist. He reports on federal environmental policy in Washington. His question that he sent to me was, how do NPR and WHYY balance the need to present facts? It's kind of a follow-up. Balance the need to present facts objectively with the president's
balance the need to present facts objectively with the president's open hostility toward media in general and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in particular. I'm concerned not in a theoretical, you just have to keep opinion out of your head sort of way, but in practice. Have you developed new editing procedures to account for this dynamic? And for that matter, are you worried about maybe going too far in the other direction and giving the administration a benefit of the doubt that they don't deserve?
I would say we haven't developed new procedures, but we've doubled down on the basics. That we strongly feel we're not the enemy, we're not the opposition, but that if we start behaving like the enemy or the opposition, we're just shooting ourselves in the foot because we'll be open to all sorts of other criticisms. So what we need to do is just stand with the facts, make sure we've got our stories straight, hold them accountable, hold the Democrats accountable for their issues. And again, I know I'm repeating myself, but give people the information they need to make the decisions about where this nation needs to go. And maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I tend to think that that's how we best serve the nation.
Is there a check when you're looking at the kind of stories you're covering for, like, are we being vindictive here? Are we being overly defensive in our choice of coverage? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it comes up, and you want to always check yourself on the tone of the way you're saying something. You know, even a simple word like "even," you know, even the Republicans are now, right. You know, that can sound wrong. Yeah. So you always want to check yourself on the tone of those sort of things, and sometimes we get it right, sometimes we don't.
Thank you.
There are, I will say that there are some listeners who, we get complaints from both sides of the aisle, folks who think we're being going overboard to sort of talk to the administration, and those who feel we're being too tough on the administration. I think one of the challenges of this environment is that the Republicans themselves are not all of the same point of view, and so you have... It can come across as a bias, if you will, because you have, you know, maybe Republican sources that are criticizing the administration, as well as Democratic sources that are criticizing the administration. I think it's a very tricky reporting environment to get that balance right. To my mind, NPR is doing a pretty good job, but it is hard for the listeners to sort of parse that all out and hear it sort of in a neutral way, if you will.
We often like to say that if we get equal criticism from both sides of whatever divide we're talking about, we're doing our job right.
Yeah. We're completely wrong, yeah.
Right. Everybody's wrong.
Exactly.
Thank you. How about a couple more questions?
Hi, my name is Caitlin. I'm a sociology student at Arcadia University. I wanted to ask, in this age of fake news, there's been also an uprising of hate groups and neo-Nazism. And though it's important to report on these stories, some people argue that these groups are like bullies and feed off of the attention that the media gives them, which causes them to act out more. So as reporters, how would you balance this with giving the people facts, and how would you present these volatile stories in an unbiased way?
Which relates to the question that we've heard, when there's something like a mass shooting, how often do you state the name of the shooter? And I know that that's been a lot of discussion in NPR about that.
Yeah, address that one first. We've unfortunately had to discuss this many times in recent months, years, and we've tried to stress that we don't need to say the name of the gunman, the shooter, the attacker in every story. Yes, it is part of the story. It's part of the fact of what happened. You do want to find out who this person was and why they did what they did. But there is considerable evidence, the researchers say, that repeating the name over and over can glorify, mythologize, whatever word you want to use, that person. So our guidance has been, go easy on the name. And in fact, if you listen to some of our stories, we don't even tell you the name after the first day or two. We just refer to it as a shooter. The other one, yeah, it is hard, like with Charlottesville. We went into that weekend. Yes, we had reporters ready. We knew that something could happen, but we weren't going to do a lot in advance to promote that there were going to be protests, but we were ready in case it happened. It did, obviously. Once that story broke, you had to cover it, and you had to try to explain what happened and why it happened and who these characters were. But we're very conscious of that sort of balance between giving people with repugnant views and opinions more publicity in advance versus covering the story. And I don't know that we get it right all the time, but as I apologize many times, a lot of my answers begin with "it depends," and it's another one where it depends.
Okay, thank you.
All right, one more question.
Hi, I'm Victoria Dubendorf. I am an MSP major, and I'm going down the audio track.
What does MSP stand for?
Oh, Media Studies and Production. Sorry. So I was wondering, I got in a situation before where I was interviewing someone, and they were telling me their history of their life, but there was some like parts of her life where it got a little bit messy. So in the future, if I do an interview and I want it on the air or I want it in a newspaper, what do you think I should do if, so the person gives me consent and I'm able to use whatever she, well, they say, but it's a little bit too risky for going out there in the media?
It sounds similar to what I was talking about earlier. So messiness in that the person would be at risk, or?
Kind of. Like, they gave consent, yeah. And I just don't want them to, like, be stalked or anything.
I think that, you know, if there's real personal safety involved and this is a civilian person and, you know, you're not going to be, I don't think you want to put a story out there that's going to put someone's livelihood at stake. I think that's what you're referring to. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I would be comfortable walking away from a story if it felt like it was going to, in the end, do more harm to an individual, and it's not going to be that revelatory to anything larger anyway. Other thoughts from the panel?
Yeah, we talk in our guidance about respect for people who are in vulnerable positions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And especially people who aren't used to dealing with the media may not realize, again, this darn internet, that the story is going to be there, it's going to live there. They may regret having told you that. You know, I would suggest if it's a story, you still think there's a story there and that person has an interesting story to tell, go back to them and say, you know, some of the things you told me are really personal or private or could cause you problems down the road. Are you really comfortable with us reporting that?
Mm-hmm.
You might end up deciding the person is comfortable, but you or your newsroom are not, because you know that 4 years, 5 years down the road, it could cause them a problem.
Yeah. Thank you.
And you know, the one thing, I mean, we talk about that darn internet, but the internet has forced us to have these kinds of conversations. Before, you know, back in the Stone Ages when I first started reporting, those conversations weren't had. It was like, get the story,
right.
You know.
We
had conversations like that, but getting the story, it was like a get the story at all costs climate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially when you were operating in a city that where two newspapers were battling for readership, which I often found myself in a city where that was the case.
Yeah.
But thank goodness for the internet, because editors now know that the story is going to live in perpetuity and that it could really adversely affect people's lives. And so, knowing this, we as journalists have become more compassionate, I would say.
Yeah.
More careful and
compassionate. And, mm-hmm. And that I believe that that's a good thing, because no story is worth putting somebody's safety at stake or reputation, you know, killing a student's reputation or anything like that. So I think that we just have to turn on our humanity chip sometimes and, you know, kind of judge things from there.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you to everybody. Thank you to all of you for coming. Thank you, Mark Mehmet, Elizabeth Jensen, Annette John Hall, and
Kevin McCrory for participating. It's been a great evening. And this has been recorded. It'll be posted on the whoi.org website, I would say sometime tomorrow. Not sure. Sandy, do we know? We're not sure. It'll be there. Better be tomorrow morning. Thank you, everybody.
That's the worst.